What is a tickle bee?
Ah, what is a tickle bee? So there's a group of kids at a school in Portland, Oregon, that have nicknamed the bees that live out in their play yard tickle bees because they are kind of bee called Andrina, at least some of which don't stink. And so when the kids handle them, they tickle. And so they are tickle bees.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Paige Embry about our native bees, North America's endangered pollinators, and the fight to save them. The book is a compilation of personal narrative, environmental travelogue, and scientific fact, all accompanied by artful bee portraits. We begin by explaining the difference between honeybees and pollinators and why it matters.
Well, a pollinator is just anything that pollinates a plant. And there's an estimated 200,000 different animals that pollinate plants, everything from birds to bees. And honeybees are just one of them, but they're the one that we have turned into a workhorse, a managed bee. So they're used widely in agriculture, but they still have plenty of places where they fly around wild, just like every other bee.
Maybe that, I'll ask it a different way too, is what's the difference between wild bees and managed bees?
Ah, okay. So a managed bee is one that people bring to certain areas with the idea of having them pollinate usually crops. Honeybees are a little special because sometimes they're used for their honey-making abilities as well as their pollinating abilities. And so honeybees are the most widely occurring managed bees, but there's others. There's maybe 10 or 12 in the world that are also managed, but none as widely and pervasively as the honeybees are. So all of the other bees that are just out there in the world doing their thing and flying around and pollinating whatever it pleases them and living wherever it pleases them and doing it according to the natural schedule, those are the wild bees.
Will you begin by reading us the introduction of your book?
Sure. Native bees are the poor stepchildren of the bee world. Honeybees get all the press, the books, the movie deals, and they aren't even from around here, coming over from Europe with the early colonists. In 2015, when President Barack Obama's White House issued a plan to restore 7 million acres of land for pollinators and more than double the research budget for them, it was called the National Strategy to Promote the Health of Honeybees and Other Pollinators. 4,000 species of native bees, not to mention certain birds, bats, flies, wasps, beetles, moths, and butterflies, reduced to other pollinators. Sigh. Honeybees are fine bees. They dance and make honey and can be carted around by the thousands in convenient boxes. But from a pollination point of view, they aren't super bees. On cool, cloudy days when honeybees are home shivering in their hives, many of our native bees are out working over the flowers. Bumblebees do their special buzz pollination of tomatoes, blueberries, and various wild species. Squash bees wake up early to catch the big yellow squash blossoms while they're open. The trusty orchard mason bees are such hardworking yet slovenly little pollen collectors that several hundred can pollinate an acre of apples that require thousands of honeybees. Where are the book and movie deals for these bees? Well, I'm making a small start for them here.
Usually when I read scientific nonfiction books, I find myself going so slowly through them and trying to metabolize every fact. And I think a quarter of the way through your book, I just threw up my hands and said, I'm just going to go along for the ride. And I could do that because the narrator in the book is so voicey and engaging. It made me wonder, Paige, who are your favorite nonfiction authors?
Well, McPhee. And in part, I think because as I studied geology, and so I remember reading his books back in the day and being amazed that somebody who was not a geologist could so nail so beautifully geology for people. And it was You didn't have to be a geologist to do it. In fact, maybe it's easier to do it if you're not a geologist. I like Elizabeth Colbert. Those are the two that jump to mind.
And then how would you describe your style in terms of balancing narrative and fact?
I had readers who were non-scientists for a lot of this, who would reel me back in sometimes when I would get caught up in talking too much about all of the science, because it's like, well, we want more of the story.
Right.
So you need to get back to the story. So there, I had that to reel me in. But when I first started learning about bees 4 or 5 years ago, and I was reading about bees and reading a lot of like guidebooks about bees, because that's mostly what's available. And the facts would go in and they just sort of slip right back out again. And it wasn't until I sort of started putting them in stories that the facts started sitting more. So I'm not sure that I can divorce the story from the facts so much. But I think the story is an essential part of it.
I want to stay with the facts for a second, because there were some really cool facts that I learned, including that we owe 1/3 of our bites to pollinators, and that baby bees eat 250 times per day. So I wanted to ask you, what is your favorite bee fact?
Well, I like there's a little anecdote in the book. And so there were a bunch of different bees out pollinating sunflowers, and one of them is called Diadasia. And it just, the honeybees would come and they would steal the pollen off the back of the Diadasia's legs. And it just, and once a honeybee started stealing from a Diadasia, it's like, well, thievery is so much better than getting it from the flower is. And it just, I don't know. It just amazed me that there were, A, bees that would put up with the thievery, that the bees would think to start stealing off the back of somebody else, and that they would then sort of make a decision that, well, we prefer to get it from the bees' hind legs than from the flowers themselves. And it just makes them seem like animals.
Right. There's a social nature to them. Can you, in really basic terms, describe the social structure of bee colonies and hives?
So there's a range of social structures, from solitary bees, which is what most bees are, who live their entire lives alone. So the bees emerge as adults, they mate, the guys die, because that's sort of all they're about. Mm-hmm. And the females collect pollen and nectar for their babes, lay their eggs, that lasts for maybe a month or so for most of them, and then they die. So that's one end of a spectrum.
Yeah.
And at the other end are the highly social bees, like the honeybees, which have colonies where you've got a whole bunch of bees of different generations living together. And they divvy up the workload. So there's the queen who's laying the eggs, and you've got worker bees, who some of whom go out and collect pollen, and some go out and collect nectar, and some are involved in honey making, and some take care of the queen. The guys, again, don't do any work around the nest, so they're just sort of around when it's time for mating. So those are two ends of a spectrum, but there's actually bees that fall into all sorts of in-between places. And it was fascinating finding out what some of those little in-between places were.
How did you get your start in the bee world?
I learned about 5 years ago that honeybees can't pollinate tomatoes. And so honeybees are not native to North America, and which I did know. But I was surprised that I did not know that honeybees can't pollinate tomatoes, because I've been a gardener for decades.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how did I miss this?
Right.
And I felt sort of like a dope. And then I started asking other people, and hardly anybody knew that honeybees can't pollinate tomatoes, but that a number of our native bees, those that evolved right here, can. And so I thought, people should know about this. I'm going to write gardening articles, and I'm going to teach gardening for pollinator classes, so because people should know who's out there pollinating their tomatoes. And I started reading about the bees, and I sort of fell in love with them.
What do you mean when you say bee people are different from the rest of us?
Certainly, the where I use it in the book is I'm out in the field with the head of pollination services for the largest almond grower in the country, because there's a chapter on honeybees in the book, even though they're not native. And he's out there working with the bees, and he works with no gloves, which I found astonishing. And so I asked him about getting stung. He's like, oh, I get stung. Like, it's not even worth mentioning. And he's like, I got stung twice today. I'm sorry I didn't show you. You can watch the little, watch it pulse as it's putting the venom in. And I'm just looking at him going, you're sorry you didn't show me the stinger. And he could get stung dozens of times in a day. And it's just like, and his response is, well, that's a bad day. So that's what I meant by bee people are different from the rest of us. But there's a whole array of other stories of how they're different from the rest of us.
So what would you say are the defining characteristics of bee enthusiasts?
I think you tend to be a little bit quirky. Mm-hmm. There is the thrill of the chase that's involved. And I think there's a component of that because there are a lot of people who are involved in bees who like to go out and catch bees. You know, it really is tiny game hunting in action. So I think there's that piece that you can actually go out and hunt down. And, you know, there's people it's like, oh, I caught this, you know, very unusual bee and I'm very pleased with myself kind of thing. So there's that piece as well. And I think once you get to be sort of a true scientist rather than I like hunting bees, there is a meticulousness that's involved that's pretty astonishing. I talked to the curator for bees from the American Museum of Natural History, who is 88, still hunts bees. No, I think he's turning 90 this year.
Wow.
And is still hunting bees. And he was going on telling me about this experiment that he devised for trying to figure out if oxygen is moving in and out of cocoons, and a special glue that had to be created. And here he is. He's been doing this for all of his life, and he's still so enthused about this experiment. So I think that's sort of what makes bee people bee people.
Yeah, and there's a scene in the book when you're learning how to pin a bee. What would you call that? Are you doing taxonomy? Is that?
Well, it's a part of taxonomy because there's a lot of steps.
Right. Where you're trying to pin the bee and it's not level, and that there's this incredible importance on it being level. Can you say more about that?
So I guess the term is there's processing bees. So sometimes bees are caught in bowls of soapy water. And so their hair is all matted down and they're a mess. So you've got to rinse them off and then you blow them dry. And then you stick a pin through, the bee has three body parts. So you stick a pin through the middle section, and you're not supposed to stick it right in the middle of the middle section. It's supposed to be off to the side a little bit because there may be something you need to look at right at that midline area. So you want the pin off to the side a little bit, but the bee is supposed to be absolutely level. It's not supposed to sort of list to the left or be down by the head. And again, all of it is so that anybody looking to identify the bee, there's a lot of little bits and pieces that you look at, and they've just sort of, part of it is, I think, maybe you can identify things better, and part of it is may come back to this meticulous thing that you've got a whole box of bees and it just doesn't look very tidy.
That's right.
But nobody has confirmed that.
Right.
That's my own opinion.
Suspicion. If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Paige Embry about our native bees, North America's endangered pollinators, and the fight to save them. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the second half, Paige will address the bee-pocalypse and make recommendations for conservation. In writing the book, how did you maintain your interest and focus? And were you ever like, I can't think any more about bees or go on any more trips bee-related?
No. The short answer is no.
Yeah.
But there were, in the writing of certain chapters, I got bogged down occasionally because the story wasn't flowing very well. Mm-hmm. And so I would get sick occasionally of some story, not necessarily the sort of the bees in it. So it was more of a writing problem than a bee problem.
Yeah.
No, I pretty much happily go out still. If somebody said, oh, you want to come and learn something about some bee? Because it's fascinating going and seeing how the science is done.
Where was the favorite place you went to in the course of researching?
Maybe to Arizona, partly because I think I got to spend a couple of days there.
Yeah.
And could just sort of sink into the world mm-hmm. a little bit more, whereas most of the rest of the places that I went, I was with people for a half a day or something along those lines. And perhaps the other place was the wild blueberry fields in Maine, because we went and saw both the big blueberry barrens and a little organic field. And so you really got to sort of see the whole range of the agriculture. So part of what I liked, the bee part was cool, but actually seeing how our agriculture is done, those parts were really wonderful.
What's one recommendation that you would like to see happen in the world of agriculture in response to preserving or taking care of native bee populations?
Oh, getting rid of the Roundup.
Aha, uh-huh. Okay.
Because, you know, used to the edges of fields tended to be weedy and they were excellent nesting and forage sites for bees and also sort of bee highways.
Uh-huh.
And now there's so much of a clean sweep that there's just not much of a place for wild bees to be. So it would be an easy one. And I know a lot of farmers are probably worried about pests being located there and things like that. And again, I can't speak to the science of how valid that is or if the benefits that you would also have predators of some of those pests potentially living there might work. But that would definitely be the thing that seems like it would be helpful. Because again, I went to a couple of different farms or orchards, an avocado one and a sort of a mixed fruit one. And they had weeds under the tree and things growing everywhere. And they seemed to be able to do their production just fine.
Fine. In thinking about production, you also talk about the difference between honeybees' productivity and other bees. And also you talk about flight distances and patterns. And I would love to just hear, again, like a really civilian overview of bee work ethic.
So we don't know the bee work ethic for a lot of bees, but for a few bees there are. And one of them is the blue orchard bee, also known as the orchard mason bee or Bob.
Uh-huh. Bob.
Blue orchard bee, Bob. Osmia lignaria. And it is an early spring bee. So it's good for fruits like apples and cherries and things like that. And the thing is, honeybees, they don't like to go out when the weather is bad. You know, if it's a little cold or a little windy or a little wet, they've got some good stores usually going on in their hive. So if the weather's not that great, it's not so awful, perhaps, to take a day off. Whereas some other bees, including the blue orchard bee, go out in worse weather. And so there's a bunch of different things that sort of tend to make them, on a bee-to-bee basis, a better pollinator. So if you took, you know, okay, we've got the trials here. We've got honeybee worker and blue orchard bee female, and they're going to duke it out in the pollination fields.
Yeah.
The honeybee worker, well, some of them only collect nectar, so they may or may not even come into contact with pollen. So clearly they're not going to be doing, those ones aren't perhaps not going to be doing as good a pollination, because the blue orchard bee females, every flower they go to, they collect pollen and nectar at the same time, sort of scrabbling around in the flower. So they're sort of a little perhaps messier mm-hmm. in how they approach a flower. And again, they'll be out when the weather is colder. They tend to fly for longer hours. They store the pollen and hairs on the underside of their abdomen, and it's just dry, just sort of there, and it sticks pretty well. Mm-hmm. But honeybees actually take pollen and put it on their hind legs and wet it down, and it makes these cool, tidy little bundles. But it's not like little bits of pollen are as likely to be falling off of something like that. And honeybees sort of like to go to the same plant and stay there, whereas blue orchard bees will move between different plants. And some of our early fruit need cross-pollination. They need pollen from a plant that has different genetics. So you need a bee going back and forth between plants. And so you'll get, for some of those early fruits, it varies from crop to crop, but you may be able to put in several hundred female blue orchard bees to replace a hive of honeybees that might have 10,000 or more worker bees.
Are we marching towards the bee apocalypse?
I don't know. I think we're losing. We don't have good historical data. There are certainly things showing that there have been a lot of losses of wild native bees. They've also shown a lot of resilience, mm-hmm. the bees. And I think one of the things, and one of the things I hope people get from the book is that, you know, unlike a lot of other conservation efforts, it's like, you don't know if it does anything.
Yeah.
You hope it does.
Right.
And it's often far away and you're just one little part. But the nice thing about bee conservation is if you've got a plot of land that you have access to, you can do something for the bees. Mm-hmm. And if enough people do something for the bees, then, you know, maybe some of the slide downhill that we've seen, and there has been a slide downhill, maybe we can turn a lot of that slide around. It feels doable, unlike some other conservation issues that don't feel so doable. So there's definitely been bees that have seen tremendous losses, mm-hmm. and probably others that we don't know about that may even be extinct. So heading towards the bee apocalypse, I don't know. I think it's an avoidable bee apocalypse. So I don't know if you're heading toward it, if it's, you know, you can still sort of avoid
steer away.
It. Yeah.
Is this where the bee lawn comes in to play?
Ah, yeah, that's one of my little, I could go on little rants about that one. So the bee lawn, there are some people in Minnesota who've developed a bee lawn. So it looks pretty lawn-like. It's got regular grass, but they've also included three kinds of flower seeds in the mix with the idea, I forget how many, a couple of dozen flowers they started with that didn't make the cut, if you will, because when they cut the lawn, the flowers either died or just don't flower. There may be little leaves there, but it doesn't do the pollinators any good if there's no flowers.
Right.
So these were three that actually would flower when you cut a lawn in a way people normally cut a lawn.
Yeah.
And they found there's a lot of bees that will visit those flowers, and not necessarily even the same bees. It was clover and something called self-heal, which is prunella, and thyme.
Mm-hmm.
So only one of which is a native plant, because a lot of the native plants didn't do very well because they didn't evolve with grazers, so they're not used to being chomped,
mm-hmm.
And then having to flower again, whereas some of the European ones did. And it seems there's 30 to 40 million acres of lawn. It seems like an easy way to add pollinator habitat if we just sort of rethink what a lawn should look like. Maybe it should be something with a little bit of flowers in it. I like the look.
Yeah, and thyme, that sounds great.
And it would smell good, too.
It would smell good, too. Paige, there's a really sweet moment in the book when you receive bees for your own backyard and you're mothering them. And I'm really curious to know now, what's your relationship like to your own backyard bees?
Those bees didn't come back the next year. So I've thought about getting some more this year, or at least coming up with a better home. I think part of the problem was the home. So I don't have the mason bees, which is what they were, those bobs or orchard mason bees.
Uh-huh.
And I bought them and I brought them in and I kept them in the fridge till it was time for them to go out. And I worried about them when I put them out. But I think I'm going to work more on making nest areas. You know, I would like to make them a better home that's safer, because I think birds or squirrels or something got at their home.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to make them another good home and give them one more try. It would be my third try,
mm-hmm.
With mason bees. So I'm not sure that I'm meant to be a mason bee mother. But I think I do okay with some of the other wild bees.
Coming back to the book itself, there are some beautiful photographs of really up close bees. And I was wondering, where did the photographs come from and why did you think it was important to include these really remarkable images?
Well, you know, The photos, most of the photos came from three places. Mm-hmm. So there are two photographers who took a lot of the photos of live bees on plants, uh-huh. Roland Coville and Clay Bolt. And then there are the other photos, which I imagine maybe the ones that you're talking about that are against this black background.
Yes.
And it's like bee as art.
Yes.
And those are done out of the USGS bee lab. Who would think that the U.S. Geological Survey had a bee lab, but they do, that's run by a guy named Sam Droege. And so they have a system set up where there is a camera on rails and they take little slices of pictures, so each one is completely in focus, so you can get these incredible high-resolution photos of the bees. So that's where they came from. And when I originally was doing the book, I didn't want photos. Timber Press wanted photos,
yeah,
because they're a very photo-heavy publisher, and I wanted it to be,
yes,
literary. But then once I saw it, mm-hmm, I realized how much being able to see the bees,
yeah,
I think, makes the book.
If you could be a native bee, which one would you choose and why?
Melisodes.
Who is that? And what do they do?
Melisodes they range in size from a honeybee or a little bit bigger down to a little bit smaller. I think I would be a larger Melisodes.
Uh-huh.
They're very fuzzy bees. They're called longhorn bees because the males have these really long antennae. And the females have really hairy hind legs. And somebody referred to them, it looks like they're wearing, like, you know, 1970s or 80s flash dance leg warmers. Yeah. So they're cute. They're cute bees. And I like the males because the males, I read over and over again, people would go out and the males would, like, congregate somewhere at nighttime to sleep together because they're solitary bees. The females, or at least most of them, are solitary bees. But the males, it's like they go find each other at night and sleep on a stem somewhere, all of them together, like a little band of brothers. And so, but I think between their cuteness,
yeah,
and their behavior, I just like them.
Paige Embry studies bees from her home in Seattle, Washington. She studied geology at Duke University and the University of Montana. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.